welcome once again to the bi-weekly descent into madness that is the Image Doctors. It's today's episode is for March 29th, 2007, and it's episode number 37. Mm-hmm. And we've got a full, we just sat and came up with a full list of topics to talk about. So we've got three big things today, right?
Yep.
We're going to briefly introduce a new HP PhotoSmart printer, the PhotoSmart Pro B9180.
Yep, which the HP people were kind enough to send to us as a demo. So we've been playing with it this morning, and we're going to do more in the next podcast too. So we're going to do this as a two-parter.
Yep. Then we want to talk a little bit about adding the effect of motion to your shots.
Right.
And then we've compiled our top 10 list of advice from the last couple of, well, the last year or so of episodes.
Which actually went to 11. So since we had one more.
That's 10. Why our top 10 list is better.
Yeah, that's right.
It goes to 11.
Yep.
And then we'll have our weekly prescription.
Yep. And this prescription has to do with handling overcast skies, the white skies that you can get in certain parts of the world.
So Rick and I just received a HP PhotoSmart Pro B9180 printer, courtesy of Hewlett-Packard, as a demo unit. We have to give it back.
Darn.
But we're gonna do a two-parter, and we've just sort of set up the printer down here in the Mountain Stronghold this morning, and so we're letting it go through its auto calibration routine as we speak, which takes about an hour, so it's probably not going to finish
that. It's a busy little robot right now.
Yeah, and it's clattering away in the back. But we figured we'd spend some time talking about the basics of this printer, what it does or what it's supposed to do, and then we'll come back in either next episode or when we've had some more time to really put it through its paces from the printing standpoint, and we'll give you a summary review of the quality of the prints that it does. Mm-hmm. So we're planning on trying it for black and white printing, for color printing. We've got a bunch of different HP media that we'll try out, and we'll hopefully have a full conclusion in another couple of weeks.
Right.
For right now, we have the printer. We've set it up. And Rick, why don't you walk us through some of the basics of the basic specs of this printer? What is it? What does it do?
Sure. And before going into that, because it's going to help with that, let's talk a little bit about its competition out there, which is the Epson R2400 printer. That's obviously the target that HP had in mind. And coincidentally, that's the printer I own. It's kind of like a smaller version of the printer that you have here.
Or you mean my barbecue grill?
Your barbecue grill. Actually, that would be a very large barbecue grill, too.
It's a manly grill.
Yeah, it's huge.
Well, we'll talk about that some other time, too.
Yeah.
We've had that suggestion.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. So some of the similarities between the HP B9180 and the Epson R2400, both are high-quality printers. In terms of print sizes, they'll both support a 13 by 19 print size, and they'll do that in a borderless fashion if you want, so you can get a lot of image area from it. They both have archival inks. They use pigment inks that can last, you know, if you use the right kind of paper and stuff, certainly more than 100 years. I think we saw something on the HP here that talks about 200 years, so certainly a very long lifespan.
Longer than either of us will be around to test.
Long enough for us not to worry about it.
Right.
That's for sure. And both use 8 ink cartridges, although there is a little difference here, and we were just talking about it a few minutes ago. HP uses a little bit different strategy with the colors of ink in the printer, and we'll have to see in our test how that plays out in actual print quality. But whereas the Epson uses a couple shades of gray in addition to cyan and light cyan and magenta and light magenta, etc., the HP takes a different route. It uses just one shade of gray, but then it has two different black cartridges in there. And those two black cartridges are a glossy black cartridge called Photo Black, and then a matte black cartridge. Now, that's different than the Epson, where it has two shades of gray, and then you have to swap in and out the glossy black and matte black cartridges.
Mm-hmm. And really where this only comes into play is if you're the kind of person who likes one type of paper over the other or wants to use both. Mm-hmm. If you like one type over the other, then there's no advantage to having both the matte and the photo black in the printer at the same time, because chances are that's just taking up space. You're never going to use it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you like both kinds of output, then it can be a real pain in the butt and you waste ink having to trade out your photo black with a matte black. I know with the Epson, you've got to go through a full on routine of purging out the lines, and you know, it's a whole process that you have.
And you
to
lose
do.
Ink in the process.
Exactly. So,
and as a result, I don't do it very often at all, which is kind of a shame, because for some black and white prints, I do like the matte paper. I don't care for it much with color, but I like it for certain black and white prints. So that, you know, right now looks like an advantage with the HP, and then we'll have to see how the one gray cartridge plays into things.
That's true. So we don't know how the black and white output will look, mm-hmm. but of course that's on our list of things to test.
Yep. In terms of appearance, it's a very attractive looking printer. Nice silver and
like
dark gray
boxes.
Tones. Yeah. Yeah. It's a little bit taller than the Epson, but I think it's a little bit less deep. Not a big deal either way. They're both fairly large printers. Now, one thing that we did spot that was a little bit of a difference is that with the Epson, you can use roll paper. With the HP, you're limited to 13x19 as the largest size. That seems like an advantage for the Epson, although actually I've never used the roll paper to date. It's on my list of things to do, but I haven't used it so far.
Well, roll paper, and I have a little experience of this with the 7800. Mm-hmm. There's pros and cons to rolls. There's two real reasons why you use roll paper.
Mm-hmm.
One is economy of scale, because it's much cheaper by the foot to buy a roll of paper than it is to buy cut sheets.
Mm-hmm.
So you save some money there in the process if you can use a roll. But the other real reason why you'd use a roll is for potentially doing long aspect panoramas.
Right.
And I recently did a 5-foot wide panoramic shot, which is
huge,
upstairs in the living room now. So roll paper does give you an advantage on that end. But otherwise, it's not. 13x19 is quite large.
Yeah.
And so I don't see that as being a major
drawback.
Just
one of those things that you'll want to sort out. Mm-hmm. In your mind first, are you going to do that kind of stuff or not? And if you're not, the HP does appear to have some advantages, where it's got a very nice large tray for holding paper, whereas with mine you can't do that. You have to not quite feed them individually, but in practice that's the way it kind of turns out. Whereas with this one, you can have a whole stack of 13x19 sheets of paper in there and have it be very simple to print, especially in bulk quantities.
One of the reasons why you can hold more paper in this is that it has the front-loading paper path design.
Right.
So there's a big paper tray that's horizontal. It's not a vertical stack. It's a horizontal flat stack of paper, and you can just stick it in the front, and then it grabs and pulls it through.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a different approach to paper path that is very common with the HP printers, whereas the Epsons usually come in from the back of the printer.
Mm-hmm.
You feed from the top. So it's just a different approach.
Yeah. Other quick things, you know, before we wrap up this segment on the B9180 is, you know, setup so far has been very easy. Cartridges went in just without a problem at all. I'd say it was a little bit easier in terms of getting them in and seeing the current levels and stuff than it is on my printer. Not a big thing, but, you know, a little bit of advantage to the HP. The heads are actually separate components that we had to install, too. Those were pretty easy.
It wasn't hard. It was just it took a little extra time. More packages to unwrap, and you have to shake the ink. With all these pigment ink printers, you have to shake up the ink cartridges before you install.
Shaken, not stirred. Yeah.
And that's to suspend it's to make sure that the particles of the dye, or not the dye, I should say, the pigments are properly suspended. You have to do the same thing with the print heads. And HP recommends that you do this while they're still wrapped in the packages so that you don't have
you don't spray your fellow image doctor.
Yeah, that could
yeah,
could potentially be an issue. Now, we shook these things up, but we didn't have any, we didn't see any ink go anywhere.
No.
So it was fine. One thing we don't know exactly is what the ink capacity is. So we'll try to get an idea of cartridge life, because, you know, that's another thing. If you're going to invest in any of these printers that have 6, 7, 8, I think Canon's got a 12 ink.
Mm-hmm.
Well, each one of those you have to purchase individually. And while it's certainly better than the days where if you ran out of one color in your multicolor cartridge and you had to dump the whole thing, each of these cartridges are going to be, you know, not an insignificant cost. They're going to,
you're going to be looking at the lifespan of the printer. That's the single biggest cost you're going to be dealing with probably.
And so you're going to be looking at, I don't know what HP charges for their ink cartridges. We'll tell you that next time. We'll look it up. But you know, you figure eight cartridges probably going to be $15 to $20 a piece. So, you know, you're talking a significant amount of money here, over $100 to fully replace an ink set.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the kind of printer where you're probably going to buy it as a dedicated photo printing. This isn't your home office printer. I'm sure it will print just fine, black text on plain paper.
Right.
But the real reason you buy one of these is to use it for photos.
Yeah, and both of us have a similar setup right now where we've got a dedicated photo printer and then a cheaper, smaller printer that we use for, you know, printing, you know, just the normal kind of stuff, Microsoft Word document or, you know, whatever. And coincidentally, both of us are using HPs for that role too.
So. I have a HP LaserJet that I got, I don't know, several years ago now.
Yeah, and I've got an HP inkjet that I've had for years, and it's been very, very good.
And I just purchased this second toner cartridge for $50, and I've owned this printer now since, I think, 2001.
That's pretty good.
So, so in terms of maintenance costs, you know, in terms for your black and white printing, for your text, you really can't go wrong with one of these cheap laser printers. They do just great.
Well, I think that does it just for the basics of the printer. And like we talked about, we'll talk about image quality and
drivers and all that kind of stuff
next time.
Installed.
Yep. All right.
Cool.
But off to a good start. It looks like a nice printer.
Yeah, it should be fun to test out. I can't wait to give it a try. Now, our next topic is incorporating motion.
Right.
Into shots. And I'll be honest, I stole this idea from Outdoor Photographer, because the most recent issue of Outdoor Photographer had a nice article by Bob Crist, who we happened to interview.
Mm-hmm.
Not we, Nikonians did.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about motion and the concept of that, you know, still photography has its place and it's usually freezing action. But you can incorporate motion into your shots. And I like this topic for a couple of reasons, because it's technically somewhat challenging.
Mm-hmm.
It can give a really unique atmosphere or emotion, or it just can impart some really good feelings or interesting messages into your images. And it's something that you don't think about all the time, and it could be a good topic to try out when you're looking for ideas to break out of a creative rut.
Yeah, and the other thing that's kind of cool about it, and interestingly, the reason I was thinking about it, because coincidentally, we were both thinking about it as a topic for this week, is I was watching a video made by Franz Lanting, you know, another famous Nikon photographer, and he was in Africa, and he was photographing antelope and things like that, and you know, lots of motion blur and beautiful shots. But the thing I think is kind of cool about it too is a lot of times we obsess over getting super sharp photos. How do we stop the action, you know, while still getting good detail and stuff, and is something perfectly sharp? Well, in this case, it's a matter of saying, I'm not even going to worry about that. I'm deliberately going to have something that isn't sharp, but it may actually result in a better image. So it's, you know, kind of an interesting concept.
Yeah, and in some ways, it's almost more challenging to get a good blurred shot than it is to get a sharp shot.
Right.
Because I know for a sharp shot, all I have to do is have a fast enough shutter speed, and chances are I'll get it right.
Mm-hmm.
But to do a blur pan kind of motion blur shot that is done well takes a lot of practice.
Right.
And so we'll talk about some of these way you do it. And, you know, why? Well, first of all, let me step back for a second. Why would you want to use slow shutter speeds and blur things? And there's a couple of reasons. I mean, one for what we mentioned, you know, the creative side of it. But two is, you know, sometimes you're in a situation where you don't have a lot of light. Maybe you're not using, and no amount of increasing your ISO is going to help. You're just not going to freeze the action. So rather than pack it up for the day, here's a way, or use a flash, which might look unnatural. You could try to do some panning shots or some motion shots and get blur in the shots to get that effect. And so you can extend your shooting time by maybe an extra half an hour because you're shooting at times a day that normally you wouldn't be shooting with available light.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting thing. Now, how should someone, if you want to get motion in your shot, well, you know, hey, just shake the camera, right? I mean, there's got to be some sort of
you can do that, though. I've seen some interesting shots.
I actually tried that this
way.
Morning, but
yeah.
If you want to have motion in your shot, you're going to have to slow the shutter speed down. That goes without saying. And the shutter speeds that work, well, it'll depend on the motion, how fast your subject is moving. I mean, if you're shooting Formula One cars going by at 200 miles an hour, a slow shutter speed might be a 30th of a second.
Right.
But if you're shooting someone running or if you're shooting something like tidal motion, you might want to use shutter speeds of less than a 15th of a second or maybe even a fifth of a second.
Yep. And in addition to tidal motion, like you were talking about, it could be a stream.
Mm-hmm.
And those types of shutter speeds work very well for shots of streams.
Now, if you're going to really slow down the shutter speed to, you know, the sub 15th of a second area, and you're working in a landscape or an outdoor situation, the chances are you're going to want to use a tripod for your shots because that's just going to help you keep everything else stable.
Mm-hmm.
While things are moving in the shot, because what you don't necessarily want to do is have camera shake adding to the motion. You want the subject to be moving, but not necessarily everything else.
Right.
So moving subjects on there's two ways of looking at it. You can have a moving subject on a frozen background.
Right. And that's like the stream or the tidal motion.
Yeah, the waterfalls like or whatever. Or you could have the opposite, where you could have a blurred background and a fairly in focus moving subject. And that'd be where you pan.
Right. And if you're not familiar with panning, the whole idea is that, you know, picture an antelope crossing in front of you from maybe right to left. And it's moving along at, you know, a fairly good speed. With panning, what you do is you're following the motion of that antelope with your lens. And at any point in time, the lens is pointing at that same spot on the antelope. And you might have a long shutter speed, and you're not going to stop the motion of the camera while the shutter is open. You're just going to keep moving along with the antelope. And what it does is create a really nice look where that antelope will be relatively sharp, may not be perfectly sharp, that's okay. And then the background has this nice streaked look to it. And you've definitely seen that in photos. And if you didn't know how it was done, now you do.
And this works well with nature shots. It works well with sports shots. You know, especially those late in the day or early in the morning times, mm-hmm. where you can't.
Could be great for photos of little kids.
Mm-hmm.
That can work very well.
Now, if it gets really dark, there's another technique you can do, which is to incorporate flash with slow shutter speeds.
Mm-hmm.
And with this, the idea is that you'll use the flash to freeze the subject and get a fairly sharp subject, but you allow the shutter speed to be long enough to have ambient light in the exposure so that you're not getting just a frozen subject on a black background. You actually get the background picked up, but it's going to be blurred because you're possibly panning or there's motion going on behind the subject or in front of the subject. You've seen these where you see shots at a fair where there's all kinds of people moving back and forth and you see this blur, but maybe the one person that's the subject of the picture is sharp because the flash has illuminated them.
Now the way that people respond to images and think is they want to see the sharp image at the end of the motion, so that there's the appearance of a trail behind the subject pointing to where they came from. Otherwise, it'll look like they're going backwards. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're using flash, the key is to use what's called rear curtain sync, which is a feature found on a lot of Nikon camera bodies and with Nikon flashes. And what it does is, rather than the normal case of firing the flash when the shutter first opens, it fires the flash when the shutter closes. And so it solves that problem that we were just talking about. In that way, the trail of motion isn't in the wrong direction, and it doesn't make the subject look like they're going backwards.
Yeah, and if you're using your flash, I can't always remember, but when you use your flash, there's a couple of settings on the camera body when you to tell the camera how to use the flash. The standard is the front curtain. There's no front curtain setting.
No,
that's just the standard flash sync. And then there's a mode called slow, which is front curtain, but it allows if you're using aperture priority. What normally happens if you're just with the regular flash, if you have the flash connected in normal sync mode and you put the camera into, say, aperture priority, well, the lowest shutter speed the camera will use is generally a 30th or a 60th of a second. And you may be able to customize that to use higher speeds on some of the different Nikon bodies. But in general, you won't see the shutter speed drop below a 60th. Well, to get this effect, you need to drop that shutter speed even lower. So you want to use the slow sync or the rear sync. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. When you enable rear sync, does it automatically also use the slow?
Yes.
Okay. So that's what you'd want to do is, if you set it to slow, you're going to get you'll still have front curtain sync. So you would have the person or the subject potentially looking like they moved, backwards if there's motion. So you want to set it to that rear sync, which will give you not only the rear curtain, but also the slow synchronization speed. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're still going to be stuck with a limitation of the camera not dropping to those lower shutter speeds unless you switch to something like manual exposure mode.
The best way to learn this is just experiment. And if you are shooting digitally, you know, it's cheap and virtually free to do that experimentation. So just try it. You know, maybe try it with someone you know, have them move around, or go to some event where there might be subjects that are moving like this, and then just try a bunch of different shutter speeds and situations. One last thing I'll mention on it, and you might have some others, I don't know, but if you're using a VR lens, look on the lens, and with a lot of them, it's got two settings, normal and active. And for panning, you want it set to normal. The active setting, which is intended for situations like you're on a boat that's heaving up and down, will try to suppress motion both vertically and horizontally. The normal one will only try to suppress it vertically, so it'll allow you to pan the image, and you'll actually get a little bit sharper shot using VR on the normal setting than you would without.
Yeah, it can be really,
just in case that matters,
really fun. I've heard some very, very positive reports about using the 7200 VR when it first came out for panning. I heard it was just right. Excellent. But it does, again, it takes practice. One thing I would point out is if you're going to use these longer shutter speeds, by necessity, because of the relationship between shutter speed and aperture, you're going to either need to stop way down, or you're gonna run into the problem where there's too much light, and your meter will say you'll look through the viewfinder and it'll say high. You'll see the word HI in there because it's telling you that it's overexposed, even stopped all the way down.
Right.
So there is a way around this besides the obvious. Well, just don't shoot in the middle of the day. Well, what if you want to shoot in the middle of the day? What if the light is bright? Well, you can get a screw-on circular filter, a neutral density filter. And that usually is good for about two stops of light reduction.
Yeah, they come in different settings.
They come in different intensities. Yeah. Or if you're really in a pinch and you don't have a dedicated neutral density, plain neutral density filter, you could use a polarizer. Because a polarizer is just a neutral density filter that cuts out a couple stops of light. But, you know, it also polarizes. Well, if you can use a polarizer, just not in the... just set it up so that you don't get the polarizing effect. And you can use that in a pinch as a neutral density filter. Mm-hmm. If you're just looking to slow, you know, get a slower shutter speed.
Yeah, like, most of them will knock off about 1 2/3 stops or 2 stops of light. So that can be just the right amount sometimes.
So that's another reason why that polarizer is something that you can keep in your bag. Yep. It's a good thing to have.
So at any rate, give that a try over the next couple of weeks and see what you think about incorporating motion into your shots.
And for fun, post your images on the, you know, if you got some good motion images, we'd love to see them. Post them in the podcast feedback forum over at Nikonians.org.
Yep. All right. We're going to go to our top 10, which, as we mentioned, turned into 11 once we actually started doing it.
Right.
And the concept behind these, and a few of them we've talked about before, but it's the idea, if you're going to try to focus on just a certain set of things to improve your photos, what would that be?
Right. And we get a lot of questions. I know we've had, this is our 37th episode, and we get a lot of questions from people saying, or can you talk about this? Can you talk about that? And I know we talked about it somewhere and I can't remember. So I thought this would be a good thing to do, would just to be put a whole lot of stuff that we've given out as advice in individual episodes over the last year or so and consolidate into our top 10 lists of things that will make you a better photographer.
Right.
The high, and our number, so starting with our number one, which is, we'll do these in order of increasing importance. But the number one thing that the first thing we've come up with is get a good tripod and use it.
Right.
And by a good tripod, we don't mean that you have to buy a $500 carbon fiber Gitzo Mountaineer tripod.
It shouldn't be a $50 plastic flimsy thing though either.
Right.
Right.
Get something that can hold your camera equipment and not flex.
And that you're going to use.
And when you start using good camera support, you will start seeing sharper pictures, better pictures, and everyone will wonder how you got it so sharp. You'll be able to print them larger. All these things will follow. So that's a really good thing. If you don't have a tripod, get one and don't skimp on it.
And if you think your lenses aren't sharp enough, get a tripod. It's probably the absence of a tripod that's the problem.
The next topic that we have, the next tip that we have is related to that, is learn to use your flash and consider investing in something more than just the pop-up flash on your camera. Now, the pop-up flashes on your camera are really convenient things.
Right.
But get to know your flash, because there's a lot of times where if the light isn't there, you need to bring your own light. And using a flash will allow you to shoot in more with better quality images in places that, you know, ambient light is just not going to cut it. Weird lighting, you know, weird white balance, forget it. Just use a flash. It'll fix it. So learn to use one and consider getting a shoe mount flash. And there's all kinds of them. There's, you know, SB600, SB800, and now there's a SB400, right? Which is a very inexpensive D40 targeted accessory. Yeah,
but get one, learn how to use it, and then consider using it more often than you're currently doing.
Mm-hmm. It'll fix a lot of, you'll get a lot of better pictures that way.
Next one is learn the basics of exposure. Learn the effects of aperture and shutter speed on your image, both in terms of what they'll do in terms of brightness and then the effects that they have. And there are lots of good books out there. But one of the best things you can do, again, is experiment.
Yeah, and sort of as a corollary to that, take your camera out of program mode.
Right.
And learn to use it in aperture priority or one of the other modes.
You want to be making the decisions about how your photo looks as opposed to the camera.
Correct.
Otherwise, it'll kind of make everything look about the same, typically.
Mm-hmm. Next one on our list is don't be afraid of bumping up your ISO if you're a digital shooter. We hear so much. Everyone's paranoid about noise and, oh my gosh, you know, my images aren't good enough. I was told I always have to shoot at the lowest possible ISO. Otherwise, my images will be just horrible and full of noise.
And the worst thing is when I see posts or get emails from people that have never actually made a print with their camera and they're complaining about things. And all they're doing is zooming into 100% on their computer screen. And seemingly that's all they ever do. They don't actually make prints.
Right. Which is our next thing. So don't be afraid if you've got a D200, you know, hey, sometimes the situation dictates 1600 ISO.
Yeah.
Would you rather shoot lower? Of course.
And there's some great noise removal tools like Noise Ninja and Neat Image and Noiseware. They do a fabulous job. But don't be afraid of it.
But for normal print size or sending emails, even if you didn't add noise reduction, right, you probably wouldn't notice.
No.
So don't be afraid of that, because if it means you can get a shot that you wouldn't otherwise have had, do it.
Right.
So then that brings us to the next topic, which is, don't just judge your pictures by looking at them on the computer monitor. Make some prints once in a while.
Right. Don't just be staring at them at 100%. Please.
I know.
You're missing out on the best part of photography.
And I know first of all, a monitor is not necessarily the best way to look at a picture, but that's what we have. So you have to use it as it's a tool. But I think once upon a time I calculated that using the 100% view in, you know, the one-to-one pixel view on the screen is something like using a 50x magnifying lens on a piece of slide film. We never did it. No editor ever did it. No one ever looked at your images that critically. So don't just...
This is the worst thing about digital, is that it's easy to do that.
So make some prints, people, and let that be the judge of whether or not you're making good images.
Yeah.
Okay, so then we're halfway through our list almost.
Yep. And so we're up to number 6. And this is a really important one.
And we talked about this not too long ago, but it's a good tip.
Yeah, learn to recognize good and bad light. And we talked about situations where there's good light and bad light a few episodes ago, and you know, the early morning hours, or sometimes overcast conditions can be just perfect for getting good light. The important thing is, think about it consciously. Don't just go out there at midday or in really harsh lighting situations and expect to get good results. That's when maybe you want to, you know, change your subject, move into the shadows, use the flash that we were talking about earlier, or just don't take a picture then. You know, there are some times where the best thing you can do is not take a picture.
Or I would say, if you do recognize that the light is less than ideal, know how to modify that light. Like you said, bring a flash to the party. Mm-hmm. Bring your own light to help fill in the gaps. Mm-hmm. So that's a great tip. Now, compositionally, number 7, learn and understand what the rule of thirds is. And as a corollary to that, what I mean is, don't always bullseye your subject in the center of the frame. If you look at the, whether it's nature shots or the really good image landscapes, you look at the subject, when the subject is dead center, it doesn't always work. There are times when it does work, don't get me wrong, but more often than not, the real classic, the subject will be in one of the rule of thirds locations.
Yeah. Or guideline of thirds.
Yeah, so learn the rule, know when, and then break it, but at least know that the rule is there, so that you're thinking about it when you're mm-hmm. composing an image. That's a good one. What do we got? Number 8.
Yeah, this is one that's related to post-processing images, whether you're using digital capture or you're scanning film. And if there's one tool that you're going to learn in Photoshop or its equivalent, it's the levels function. It's simple, and it can have profound impacts on your images. A lot of people, especially those shooting digital capture, that don't know about this little feature, end up getting shots that look just kind of blah. And oftentimes it's because the dynamic range of the camera exceeds that of the subject, and the shots are just not very interesting looking. There's just a lot of grays in there. And levels will allow you to determine what's a black and what's a white in your image, and then you adjust the overall brightness after you've done that. Makes huge differences in image quality. So again, if you're new to post-processing, that's the first function to learn, in my opinion.
I agree. That's the one you need to know.
Yep.
Number 9, this is one you brought up, and that's get closer.
Right.
You're never close enough.
Now, even though you might think you are, you're not.
Especially those group shots.
Right.
Get in tighter. Make your subject fill that frame. Unless you want them to look like a little speck in, with the Grand Canyon in the background, you'd be surprised. Get in close.
Your mind can play tricks on you when you look in through the viewfinder and you might have some subject in there, whether it's a person, a plant, or whatever. And you mentally kind of zoom in and ignore the outside areas of the frame, but they're still there. And when you get the print back, they'll show up, you know, as big vacant areas and it detracts from your subject.
You can have a group shot with a nice scenic background. You don't have to have everybody's feet in the picture. Mm-hmm. So get in close because you want to see faces.
A rule I heard one time in the past was go ahead, frame your shot like you think that is appropriate, and then take one step closer. And that's a pretty good guideline.
Number 10 is
this
don't
is
be
big.
Lazy.
Yeah, don't be lazy.
Don't be lazy. And what we mean by that is that getting good pictures takes some perseverance, and you have to be willing. You know, if you want to go out and find that good light, unfortunately, a lot of times that good light is available at 5 or 6 in the morning. And that means getting out there early, or it means knowing where your subject is going to be, doing your homework before you go out and shoot, thinking about your composition before you just take pictures willy-nilly.
Yeah, don't stand in just one spot and zoom in and out. Move around. You know, ideally, don't even have the camera up at your eye as you're figuring out the composition and where you want to be. The laziness factor hurts photographers more than anything else by far.
And the fact is that, you know, we've got these tools now that do everything except slice bread practically. So it's real easy to just get enamored by I'll just zoom in a little bit rather than changing your position. So don't be lazy, work at it, keep trying things that are new.
Yeah.
And then I'll leave because our list, that was 10, but our list, of course, is one louder.
Mm-hmm.
It goes to 11. And I'll let you handle this one, Rick.
Yeah, the last one is, and it's kind of a complex one that wraps in several things, but part of it is don't blame your equipment. You know, if you're not getting results that you like, don't just assume that it's, you know, a problem with your new D200 or D80 or whatever. It's probably not. It's probably not a problem with your new lens. There are always exceptions out there, but chances are it's not those things. It's just not knowing how to use them. And, you know, the analogy that I was talking about earlier when we were discussing this and putting it on the list is I think cameras and lenses are a bit like musical instruments, and I like music, so this mm-hmm. kind of resonated with me. You don't
No pun
just,
intended.
Right. you don't go out and buy a Gibson hollow body guitar and then magically start playing like Kenny Burrell or Joe Pass or some other famous jazz guitarist. It doesn't happen. People delude themselves into thinking it's going to happen, but it doesn't.
Just because you
end up sounding just like yourself, only on a little bit different guitar. And with camera equipment, it's the same way. You can see beautiful shots in National Geographic or Sports Illustrated or, you know, you name, you know, some other famous magazine. You're not going to get those shots going out and buying a D2X and a new lens. That's just not going to happen.
No. The reason why those guys who shoot for National Geographic get great pictures is because they know what they're doing with their equipment once
they
get out to the
field. Very hard.
Yeah. They learn it. They when they get a new body, they don't take it out on an assignment. They spend some time making sure that they've used that equipment so that they know how the autofocus system will work. They know how the meter will work. They know what it can do for them so that when it comes time to get the shot, they're not worrying about how to set up their camera. They've already done it and that it just becomes a tool.
But going back to the music analogy again, it takes years of learning to get good images and you never stop learning, just like with music. You know, I doubt you'll find very many musicians saying, hey, I stopped learning years ago and I'm just kind of coasting. Most of them will find that, you know, will say that they're still struggling to get a performance that they're happy with.
And how many musicians would say, well, I could play that song, but I can't do it because I need a better guitar.
Yeah.
Or I need a better keyboard to, you know, if I don't have a full grand piano, I can't make that music.
Yeah.
No, those guys who can do that, they know how to get the most out of the instrument that
they
have.
And good tools help. There is a difference, but it's not the thing that makes the profound difference. So just recognize that. Be easy on yourself at first. If you're just getting into photography, don't set your expectations so high that you can't possibly achieve them. And like we said at the start, just don't start blaming your equipment.
Well, and quite frankly, any DSLR that Nikon makes has got way more complicated. You can make it incredibly complicated if you want to. They have way more features available on even the cheapest cameras than any of our original film cameras ever had.
And they, every single one of them is capable of making beautiful photos.
So, including our old film cameras.
Absolutely.
So that's the point. So that's our list. We tried to, we'll probably come up with more tips in future to remind everyone, but we figured we'd give you a concise rundown of all the stuff that we thought was sort of noteworthy over the last year or so.
And hopefully those were helpful for you.
Okay. So we're almost done with the show today. We've got our weekly prescription, but before we go there, I wanted to just mention that, congratulations to, Bob Gagan, who won our contest from last time. He posted incredibly quickly into the podcast forums over at Nikonians.org. And he knew that the answer to the film advance rate with an MD12 motor drive on an FM2 or FE2 was 3.5 frames per second.
Yep.
Which was the right answer. And so congratulations, Bob. You won a copy of my CD-ROM, The Photographer's Guide to Capture NX, which he emailed me and said he received. So I hope you're enjoying that. And we don't have a contest for you this time, but we're going to hopefully have some more soon.
Yep.
And that brings us to the last thing on the plate for this week, which is our prescription, and it's dealing with overcast skies.
Yep. And question that I gotten a while back from someone had to do with how do you handle those situations where you end up with a sky that looks just white and is potentially blown out, whether it's print film, slide film, digital capture, really doesn't matter. It'll happen with all of them. And it is a problem and a frustration and one that you don't always spot when you're taking the photo, especially if you're using film. It's not easy to see that you've got that problem. It's a little bit easier on a digital camera where you can check the histogram and when you see things that are all blown out to the right, you know you've got a problem. The simplest way of avoiding a problem with that ugly white sky in your image is keep the sky out of the image.
I think that's the best way.
Yeah, and look for an alternate composition. Sometimes that means going for subject matter that's a little bit closer up. Let's pretend you're doing some travel photography and you're in a really nice city center or something like that. Perhaps rather than, making those shots where you've got the buildings and lots of sky in there, you do the up-close thing of something in the market. And that same ugly sky makes a really nice diffuser, and you get nice, even, soft lighting that really brings out the colors.
Yeah, so, the colors will really pop with overcast lighting.
Right.
It really, really is nice. The best wildflower pictures, for example, are usually taken on overcast days.
Now, if you've got a little bit of detail showing up in the sky, so you can see some cloud boundaries and things like that, and it's just not flat white light, then there are a couple things that you can do. One is, in some cases, you can use a graduated neutral density filter, a two-stop one, a three-stop one, to darken the sky portion of the image, but not the other area of the photo. And that'll help a lot. If you don't have a graduated neutral density filter, or there's a really awkward boundary between the sky and the rest of the subject matter, what you can do on occasion, and this works best with a digital camera, is underexpose a little bit, and then in your post-processing, compensate for that underexposure by sliding your mid-tone thing in levels, like we were talking about earlier.
Slide the mid-tone arrow to the left, and that will bring back the...
It'll brighten them up. And there's really a lot of latitude with digital capture on the underexposure side, so you can take advantage of that. That technique is going to work best at lower ISOs, like 100, 200, 400. You're still okay. When you get to higher ones, you do start bringing up some noise. that can look a little bit ugly in bigger print sizes. Smaller ones, you're probably fine. So that is one way around it. Like we were talking about earlier, the best situation is to just simply avoid the sky.
We know that's not the best. That's not always the what you want to hear, but that's the reality of it. And when you get that white sky, it just ruins pictures.
Yeah, it does.
And there's nothing you can do. And don't even think about painting in a blue sky. Yeah, I tried that once a long time. I thought I would be cute. And of course there's trees and then you get the, you know, the boundaries and it's impossible. And it looks fake. And so just don't even go there. I wouldn't. So that's good advice, I hope.
Yep.
I hope that's useful. And send us your suggestions. As always, you can email us at talkradio@nikonians.org or post in the podcast feedback forum for because both of us are moderators there and we read those all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to answer all the questions either in the forums or on the air. And we will see you again in 2 weeks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you.